Welcome to our anime show. I am a Green Queen.
And I'm Binge Monster.
So team, some pretty big news happened in the anime industry recently, and we thought that it would be an absolute dishonor on our podcast to not address the legacy and impact of the late Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z. The impact of Dragon Ball on the anime industry as a whole and how it has manifested today or come about or flourished, if you will, is really, really a testament to this show. And as much as I myself even will be like, ah, oh, people that only like Dragon Ball Z or Dragon Ball Z bros or what have you, when it comes down to it, this show is so important to the way that we consume anime, the way that it's accepted across the world. And we really need to take the time to understand this creator and his life a little bit more and the impact of him on the anime industry as a whole. So with that said, let's go ahead and start discussing the early life of Akira Toriyama. Binge Monster, do you want to hop in or do you have anything to add even to my intro?
Well, the only thing that I would add is that this wasn't an episode I did not expect to be recording this week. I didn't expect to be talking about Akira Toriyama anytime soon. He was 68 years old. And, you know, I think it kind of came as a big shock to me, and I imagine to the rest of the world. They did a really great job, his family did, of kind of keeping this hush-hush. He passed away, I believe it was early in the first week of March, and really the announcement didn't come until late last week.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you said is all really true. I don't know that, you know, besides Osamu Tezuka, who was regarded as kind of the grandfather of manga, as one of the really early pioneers of kind of making the art commercial and making it kind of known what it stylistically what it is today, and the great contributions Osamu Tezuka put forth and created and brought into this world and kind of set the tone for what anime might be from Japan. I can't think of a more prolific, more impactful mangaka than Akira Toriyama in our lifetime who's passed. And I don't know if, you know, we can really emphasize enough how impactful and how important he is, but I think we're going to do our best. I mean, this is a once in a generation kind of a guy. I think I told you, I was talking to somebody the other day that I sooner would have expected to have this conversation, not to be morbid, but just being like really transparent, like about Hayao Miyazaki before talking about Akira Toriyama. Like there's kind of these generations that, like, I don't know, like that it would have, you know, we would expect to have these conversations in order of, and this was kind of a shock.
Yeah,
I'm also very excited to talk about the life and legacy of Akira Toriyama. I think, you know, while most people in the world who've never watched anime or heard of anime couldn't name a single anime character, I think a good deal of them may unknowingly be able to name Goku, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think most recently when Japan hosted the Olympics, they actually used Goku as the
mascot, if you
mascot?
Will.
Mascot? Yeah, I guess that's them. The right word, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, kind of further cementing him as the critical, character that, you know, is known all far and wide across the world. You know, Goku and Dragon Ball Z and what that became here in America, there's, you know, a lot more to the story. And I think this is a story that really starts in his childhood. He was born in 1955, which is right on the cusping edge of World War II. And can only imagine what Japan was like in 1955, early years of his life, as they were kind of rebuilding after the country had really seen
absolute devastation,
many battles, and had kind of been flattened in many areas. And one of the things that's really interesting about where Akira Toriyama was born, which was in Kyosu, Aichi, Japan, is that this was kind of smack dab in the center of Japan, of the country. And there is a castle there that is considered to be, you know, one of the national treasures of Japan. It's called Inuyama Castle, which translates to Dog Mountain Castle in English. And it's known to have a really tall tower that still stands, or well, still stood at the time. I'm not sure if it was destroyed during, there was a pretty large earthquake in the 80s. But regardless, it's known to be an incredibly beautiful castle that held strategic importance back in the Edo period and some of the old, even the older periods. And it changed hands in terms of who owned it, but it was considered, you know, one of the more premier castles in the country that leaders at the time kind of would either own or live in. And militarily, it was always an important place right in the middle, because if folks were trying to unify Japan, whether to the west or to the east, having that stronghold in the middle was strategically very, very helpful. So this castle actually survived the war. It's one of the few that did, one of the few major ones that did. And he grew up in the town where this thing exists, where this castle existed. So I thought that was interesting. Well, but I imagine that, like, unlike some of the other areas, his area was probably, given that it was just in the smack dab center of the country and resources were probably quite thin, I imagined that there was tremendous hardships that he faced while growing up as a kid. And I also imagine that seeing this kind of pillar of strength, or this historical strength pillar in this castle, might have inspired some of his early works and might have inspired him to draw as a kind of tool to work through some of the potential generational trauma that he was sitting in
absolutely
his environment right after World War II, right? Mm-hmm. I could only imagine that that kind of gave spark to that creative outlet.
And
he was kind of a boss, though, even from like a really young age. I'm kind of excited to tell this story. And I know you had a chance to, we were talking about this before the episode recording as well. He initially entered high school with a specialization of graphic design, which is cool because I didn't even know that in Japan they had those. I didn't know that they had like specialty high schools, because I know we kind of have some of those things here in the States, but I thought that was a more modern educational concept, apparently.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, right?
But at that time, it's very interesting that he would have had the opportunity to go into that. I would agree.
Yeah. So he, you know, went to high school with that focus. It's said that he actually started drawing in elementary school, and what got his, what piqued his interest to kind of continue was that it was, his drawings were well received when he was drawing his classmates. I don't know if you did this in elementary school, but I remember there was kind of like a self-portrait day in my elementary school where we had to learn how to draw ourselves and then people around us. I can tell you with certainty, no one said that about my drawings. I'm a horrible artist. But yeah, it's cool that he kind of got started from a younger age. And then kind of after that, he went to university to further his education. And he actually I didn't mean that. He actually chose not to go to university because he wanted to just jump straight into work. And when he did, he went straight to an ad agency for a number of years. And this is kind of one of my favorite stories about young adult Toriyama. In the beginning, his main job was creating designs for this ad agency. But he quit his job because he was always late and he only wanted to wear casual clothing, and he didn't like the fact that, you know, he had to wear very formal clothes when going to work. And he's like, this life isn't for me. I'm quitting. I'm going to go be an artist.
He's such an artist. Like, that whole concept, it also tickles me. It just goes like, yo, you, as you said, this guy is a boss from day one. He's just like, you know what? I'm not doing it this way. And I don't need to. That's crazy.
It's kind of cool, too, because one of the things that he says about why he thinks he was able to be so successful in his career, he says that his time at the ad agency played a big role in that because he had to meet deadlines for his clients. There was no, there was no wiggle room. You had to deliver. And so that kind of developed his sense of urgency, his work ethic. And then when it came time to handing over deliverables back to his publishers, he kind of retained that, you know, reflex, that instinct, and that work ethic to deliver something, you know, on time. So he really credits his time then. But again, he was like, if I'm going to work, I'm going to do it my way.
We're going to do it my way.
Yeah. So after quitting, Akira Toriyama actually was pretty broke. So he needed to quickly find a source of income. And truly on a whim, he applied to Kodansha's weekly shonen magazine.
Like one-shot thing?
Yeah, but it was like a contest. Oh, right? That was the word I was looking for.
Okay.
And apparently when he submitted, it didn't match up with the timing of the contest, and he didn't know that. And so Kodansha didn't take his submission, but he ended up submitting to Shonen, to Weekly Shonen Jump, and they actually took submissions monthly, and I think he still had time to submit that one, and so he did. And the editor at the time, who couldn't possibly have known how successful this guy was going to become, probably saved his whole career. His initial one-shot concept was rejected by the editor.
Yeah.
Saying that, like, hey, this is really good, but you're actually kind of ripping off Star Wars, so we can't do this.
It was like a parody or something,
I love that he was so influenced by Star Wars, too. That's hysterical.
Shouts out Star Wars. You also still love Star Wars so much. I do, too.
I do. But I do, yeah. So I didn't know this about him, that he was a Star Wars fan. But yeah, he had submitted kind of like a parody of Star Wars, and so they denied it because it wasn't wholly original. And the editor, however, was so impressed with his work that he actually sent him a personal letter and encouraged him to continue creating and continue submitting. And I think that, like, would have walked away. I mean, I was reading a number of articles about this, and there's a pretty unanimous historical kind of consensus that he was pretty ready to quit. And very fortunately for us, he chose not to. And a big part of the reason he didn't, even after continuing to submit and to continue to get denied, was because apparently he was pretty stubborn, and he wanted to prove people wrong, and he wanted to kind of, prove people that he can create something great. And eventually he actually was successful in getting something picked up, and he created a number of one-shots. And eventually one of those one-shots became something a bit larger. His first major work was Dr. Slump.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know about Dr. Slump, especially a lot of Dragon Ball fans. But, you know, if you were to Google, like, who are some of the strongest characters in anime, one of the characters that would come up is the daughter of the doctor in the story of Dr. Slump, Areli, or Areli, how I don't know how you actually pronounce that, who may even be stronger than Goku, this, like, little girl who was, like, a robot that was one of the first characters that Akira Toriyama made and Dr. Slump. And, yeah, I mean,
that's so interesting, because I had no idea this existed. And I actually would be really interested to be a fly on the wall to any Dragon Ball fans that listen to this that also hear about this that didn't know about Dr. Slump. I would love to, because, like, I don't know, like, because Toriyama is so known for Dragon Ball Z, mm-hmm. And Dragon Ball in general, I really just feel like people think that this maybe is the only thing that he's ever done. And, like, yeah. I mean, it rightfully so, because it's so important, and, you know, good in a lot of circles and people that enjoy that kind of content. But yeah, I would be very interested to hear what other people think about Dr. I wonder how the views of Dr. Slump will go up after, in the next couple months and so forth.
Yeah, that'd be a really interesting thing to pay attention to. I mean, it was adapted for 243 episodes. So this wasn't just the anime of the manga for Dr. Slump was adapted for 244. So this actually was a lot bigger than I think people even really realize. It was it was something that and I know we're going to talk about some of the other mangakas that Akira Toriyama influenced, but it was something that many mangakas referenced after his passing, because when they were younger, Dragon Ball hadn't come out yet. So when the mangakas of our time and our generation were in elementary school, many of them were reading Dr. Slump because that's what was coming out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon Ball had not been created yet. So they accredit that transition of initially reading Dr. Slump and then eventually reading Dragon Ball as some of the most influential works that inspired them to go off and become mangaka. So yeah, people shouldn't sleep on Dr. Slump. It's you know, it's one of those, I was talking to somebody the other day that I work with, and they were saying, like, he is your favorite mangaka, right?
Yeah.
Which is, like, I think a really good way of characterizing Akira Toriyama. One thing I thought was really interesting, though, is even after Dr. Slump was picked up and even after it started to gain some real success, he was interested in actually quitting after 6 months of creating it, because he was kind of... He was kind of excited to tell other stories and to do other things. And I actually think this is really interesting. And I don't want to gloss over it because, again, I do genuinely believe that he was super influential, particularly on the mangakas of our time. And I actually think that this point is another example of why. Because I hear often... Even from the, for example, like more recently, the mangaka of Spy Family had come out and said, like, I don't love, like, this isn't the story I want to tell, but everyone loves it. And so I keep going for the fans.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear that either directly or very subtly or indirectly from mangakas that, you know, when their show gets picked up or what have you, eventually they're like, I want to tell other stories, but, like, people keep asking me to continue. And quite frankly, sometimes the publishers are like, no, you need to keep going.
Yeah, you need to do this.
Yeah, and you can kind of tell sometimes, too, where things are really, they're really milking a title for all that they can. I'm not gonna call out any names here, but you can kind of tell. So I thought it was interesting, right? Like, I don't know how many mangaka of this era were kind of forced to keep going, but he was one of them. So I think it was Kodansha or whoever, it might have been Toei, I'm not sure, but one of his publishers basically said, like, no, you can't stop Dr. Slump until you have another thing. So you need to submit for other things. And he was it launched his career, truly. It really put him on the map. But even then, like, he still needed to have something. And the next thing that he created wasn't Dragon Ball. It was a series of other short stories or one-shots that, you know, were either successful or not successful. And eventually, he actually adapted a story from a Chinese tale. And the title of it was called Dragon Boy. And it was it was heavily influenced from Chinese folklore, and Dragon Ball is heavily influenced from this folklore. And Dragon Boy eventually was super well received by people, and it brought in his kind of love for martial arts for the very first time, and people wanted more of that. So eventually he ended up creating a decently new story.
Mm-hmm.
I say decently new because it was somewhat different from Dragon Boy, but it was definitely kind of like that next evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave birth to Dragon Ball. And that is kind of where everything changed, I think, for him and for the whole anime world. One of the things that I think is really interesting about Dragon Ball, and I read this kind of, which validated this point a little bit for me when I was looking at what other people were writing about Akira Toriyama's legacy, is that one of the things that really changed the game, when you look at some of the other titles that came out around this time, like Fist of the North Star and just other things in kind of the 80s that were in the shonen umbrella that were becoming really, really big. And by the way, like Fist of the North Star is a huge title too. I was looking up the rankings of like most valuable franchises in anime, and it's like right up there. It's a huge title, and I didn't even realize how big Fist of the North Star was. But the point that I wanted to make is that Dragon Ball introduced a main character that might have been the strongest in the universe, but was also like the smallest, because Goku, who he created, was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, an alien who came from out of space and landed on Earth and, you know, was raised by a martial arts master and cultivated his skills. But he was a child taking on full grown adults. And I think the thing that made this important is, like, no longer was the biggest character in the room the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a child. It could be this little kid. It could be this kind of RPG in a story theme where over time this character levels up. And that created kind of that, I don't know if I want to call it archetype, but that theme in shonen that, like, now we see as like as just a staple of what it means to be a shonen today.
Mm-hmm.
Where you start from kind of nothing and then you cultivate your power over time, and you watch that evolution, and like that's just like a trope of shonen, and I think in many ways he kind of established that with Dragon Ball. So yeah, I mean, Dragon Ball came out in the 80s, you know, subsequently there were a number of series that came from that, right? Like Dragon Ball Z came shortly after Dragon Ball as kind of like the sequel to Dragon Ball. You know, earlier in his mangaka career, he was excited writing about like comedy and writing about, you know, just different themes that he found really interesting. He was an exceptional storyteller, especially visually. That was like one of the big things, was that visually he was known to be a generational talent, and that creating that world through the characters that he designed and the creatures that he designed and the landscapes, like these were some of the things that really captivated people and distracted people from everyday life and kind of what put him on the map. But, you know, I think one thing that I thought was really interesting is the subsequent series that came after Dragon Ball Z, Dragon Ball GT, and Dragon Ball Super, all kind of sequels one after the other of each other, with the exception of GT, which feels like it's like a multiverse kind of a thing, which we won't get into today. But his level of involvement definitely changed between the series. So like with Dragon Ball, he was exceptionally hands-on. He was the creator, he was the writer, he was the illustrator, he was like a little bit of everything. Of course, he had a staff to help him. And he continued to do that with Dragon Ball Z. But with GT, for example, he was only the character designer, and that's it. He let other people kind of take the franchise forward. And in that time, he was focused on some other things, like video games, which we'll talk about in a moment. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, and then with Super, he kind of came back and wanted to be a little bit more hands-on again and kind of get involved in the in not just the character design and the illustration, but also the writing and so forth. So he had different levels of involvement throughout the kind of four series of the Dragon Ball umbrella. And that allowed him to have the flexibility to explore other stories that he also put out in parallel, either one-shots or work on video games. And even in preparing for this episode, I didn't realize how involved he was with other video games. I somehow embarrassingly didn't even know he was involved in Dragon Quest.
I had no which makes sense idea.
When you look at Dragon Quest, though, like it totally does have similarities in the art style that to like the Dragon Ball universe.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who like don't know, like Hero, for example, and from what's it called? Smash. Isn't that also from Dragon Quest? I think it is.
Oh, I don't even know.
I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I would believe you. All I know is the dragon.
So I mean, besides his manga success, which again we'll talk about, you know, how big this was in a moment, but just wanna give some space to his success on the video gaming side. You know, initially he was signed to help create some artwork and character designs for an upcoming video game. This is again in the late 80s, right around the time when Dragon Ball had kind of launched itself into fame and he was becoming really well known. He was asked to do this and the game was called Dragon Quest, and he didn't know anything about the game, and let alone like kind of what an RPG was. That wasn't really a big thing back then like it is today. And apparently they loved him so much that, and the art that he was providing, that he became kind of the key character designer for every evolution of Dragon Quest, which is a title that continues to put out new versions even to this day. It's one of the most successful, well-known, most beloved RPG series of all time, in Japan especially. So just thought that was really interesting. Like, you know, that was his initial entry into video games. And of course, anybody in America who grew up playing the Dragon Ball Z video games knows that he was heavily involved in a lot of those in video games here as well. We've talked about it on this podcast too, even when we had Rion on, like Budokai Tenkaichi and Kakarot more recently, that put out tons of games. Mm-hmm. And I know that he was heavily involved in a lot of those. And it stands out to me when I was playing those games when I was younger, that the coolest part about it is you could fly around the world, the world that he created, and mm-hmm. you could fight in the air. And I look back on that with a very different lens now, just thinking about how he probably, instead of making it a game like most games where you're like walking around the world, like the ability to just fly from city to city, like mm-hmm. he probably really wanted to give its, you know, his fans and the users of his video game that opportunity to like see his world in the eyes of Goku in a really cool way. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, I don't know. I just think that's pretty special. And I look back on that in a very different way now. And the video games were exceptionally successful. I mean, I think that as of 2022, there'd been like 70 million units of games sold in the Dragon Ball Empire. And, you know, as a franchise, though, like beyond video games, when we're talking about merchandise, video games, manga sales, movie sales, everything, there are around $24 billion that have been, grossly generated under the Dragon Ball franchise. And to put that into context, if you were to think about the most successful media franchises of all time, Dragon Ball would rank 15th of all time. And that puts it one rank above Barbie, just to put that into context, which is obviously a huge global phenomenon and quite relevant right now, especially because because the movie came out, right? But and it's only one place behind Batman.
Wow.
And not by much, by like $1 billion, which that does sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of this, like, you know, Dragon Ball generated $24 billion. So, and there are more things that are coming out in the coming years too that I imagine will propel the franchise forward and maybe even eclipse Batman. That's actually possible. So I just wanted to put that into perspective for our listeners, because Dragon Ball is a huge franchise, and people, you know, many people may not know that.
I mean, absolutely. So, especially when you're talking about like the franchise, like this is something, to your point earlier, where you could go to almost any part of the world, almost any, and someone's going to at least know Goku. I mean, through music, through like other references in other places, like it is very unsurprising, but honestly a little bit surprising to me that it's only the 15th highest. Because of how well known, and like you could walk into any like comic or nerdy store and there's something Dragon Ball in there.
Yeah, I agree. I actually was rather shocked also that it was only 15th, especially because, you know, like many, many other things, including, you know, heavily influencing that kind of trope of, you know, shonen characters leveling up over time. I think he also paved the way for other shonen mangakas, particularly the larger franchises, to see, like, to kind of pave the way of, like, what's possible when you have a really successful title. Like, the fact that there are figurines and video games and manga sales and movies and live actions, which are questionable, and we could talk about that. In fact, we've already talked about that. But, and just all these other avenues of generating, you know, revenue. The other thing that I think is important to put into context is, like, I don't know that those dollar figures are accounted to adjust for inflation. Like, I wonder how that would change things here, right? Like, $500,000 in 1980 is very different than $500,000 today. So, you know, I wonder how inflation, you know, factors into this. But, I mean, the influence alone to just show what's possible and to find that that global success, not just the success in Japan, which is, I don't want to say more common, but, or maybe easier to achieve, but that,
I mean, it
global
originates
success.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have the data to back this up, but I remember reading somewhere that like Dragon Ball is globally still the most viewed title of all time. Like, and I don't have, like I said, I don't have the data to support that, but I'd believe it, right? There are these memes. I don't know if you saw this, but there are these memes that, like, the cartels, and I don't think there's actually, I don't, you know, unfortunately, I don't think there's actual truth to this, but, you know, I'd seen some memes that, like, cartels in Mexico had ceasefired the day that it was announced out of respect.
Oh, God.
And I had also seen, and this one I think may be actually true, but I have to confirm it. The Dragon Ball is the most illegally streamed show globally, particularly produced when streamed by even governments. So there are like countries whose governments would actually run an illegal stream of Dragon Ball, like in cities or in towns or what have you, and everybody would gather around to watch it. And again, I have to kind of validate that, but wouldn't be surprised.
No, certainly not. I think it's also a very interesting, because it's like there are so, because of the impact of Dragon Ball, like, and so many people have watched it, and like, it's not, you know, it's not an unknown fact that like anything that is like a shonen, and this being, I don't know, I would argue like one of the most popular and successful shonen of all time, it's geared towards like, you know, young men. And so now it's very interesting, like the amount of grown men that maybe a year or two ago or even 5 years ago would not have sort of admitted to their grief and like heartbreak over this passing because of the impact and how much Dragon Ball might have shaped them into who they are, you know, as grown men. Like, I think, I don't know, I think that there's something also in there that maybe I'm not being as specific as I could about, but I think that that is also something that, like, you know, like the Weeknd put out something about this, Metro Boomin, like these people where I'm like, you watch anime? But like, of course you do. Of course you grew up on Dragon Ball. Like, it's these things that I find that are kind of very, like, they make me a little happy because I'm like, everybody loves anime. Like, it's an undeniable, like, a lot of people who watch this really, really love it. And yeah, just a testament to, like, again, its impact and how important it is, and just some things that I've been observing and seeing on the internet.
It's really interesting too, because I also, and I'll touch on this very briefly, an observation that I've made is that, especially in this country, minorities in particular heavily gravitated towards this title.
Yes.
Growing up, it is super popular in the African American community.
Yes.
It is also super popular in the Hispanic community.
Yeah.
And when I think back on, like, the classic tale of, like, okay, at a very young age, people would mimic the Kamehameha, like, on the playground. And eventually, like, when I think about people who, you know, when they got to a certain age were bullied for watching anime, you know, a lot of people were pretty obsessed with Dragon Ball Z, and eventually that kind of became like the weird thing. And then in adolescence, it kind of came roaring back and people went back to it because they were a little bit more sure of themselves. And, you know, but I just think it's really interesting just to kind of analyze that for a second, like why it was so popular with minorities, particularly in America. And I have to imagine, I think I even read something similar to this from a publisher of a magazine somewhere here. And somebody had done an interview. I think it was NPR did an interview with someone who was African American and grew up watching anime. And one of the things that they said was, the reason, and he was more talking about it through the lens of African Americans, but I think this translates to just all minorities. The reason that African Americans resonated so much with Goku and why it was so successful in that community is because in many ways, like, Goku is a stranger trying to make it in the world, and kind of is the odd one out, and kind of is somebody who had to tackle, in order to find success, many, many hardships, and just took them head on, like, just put, you know, the world on his back to find success in his life. And I think, you know, minorities in this country can resonate with the need to do that, just to find success. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons, is that, but I just think it's particularly interesting to think about, like, that was the anime in particularly the 80s and the 90s that kids would mimic on the playground heavily and then eventually get bullied for. And then eventually in their adolescence, you know, everyone grew to know Goku. And I always wonder if, especially those people who to this day are like, you still watch anime and, like, you know, whatever. Like, I wonder if they can appreciate, like, what Goku became and what he symbolizes and, like, how successful this title is and still is to this day.
Yeah, I think so.
Fathom that.
I think there's also probably a great deal of people who you know, would say like, oh, that's weird that you watch that. And, you know, because they were shamed out of watching it or what have you, that like have gone back to watch it in secret.
For sure.
Like you've gone back to watch it even. Like, so I don't know. That would be my optimistic guess, I'll say.
Well, you brought up the outpour of support from other people, and I want to highlight two in particular, and as people who, upon the news of his passing becoming public, released letters, and I'll actually put the full letters in the description of this episode in case you want to read them all. But I just wanted to read two very quick excerpts. Is that the right word?
Yes.
Yeah. One from Eiichiro Oda, who is the creator of One Piece, and then one from Musashi Kishimoto, who is the creator of Naruto. And I just wanted to read a quick excerpt of what they said because it's very reflective of how impactful Akira Toriyama was on even them and creating their shows. So I'll start with Oda's message. And he wrote, "It still feels too sudden. I feel a huge hole has pierced through my heart. The thought of never seeing you again fills me with sadness. I've admired you so much since I was a child. I vividly remember the day you called me by my name for the first time. I remember when you called me a friend for the first time, and I remember the last conversation we had. You took the helm in an era when reading manga was considered a foolish waste of time. You forged an era where both adults and children could not read and enjoy this medium. Could read. Mm-hmm. You showed me that manga could achieve such a thing. You made me dream that I could reach the whole world. You were my superhero." And this is, again, from the creator of One Piece. Musashi Kishimoto, the creator of Naruto, also wrote a beautiful letter too. He starts by saying, "Quite frankly, I don't know what to write or how to write about something so sudden. But I would like to express my thoughts and feelings towards Toriyama Sensei, something I wish he himself would have asked me someday." Which is terrible, terribly sad to hear. Yeah. But I'll read this. Just one excerpt from his letter. He said, "Today I received the news of my master's death. I feel an even greater sense of loss than when Dragon Ball ended. I don't know how I'll deal with this hole in my heart. Now I can't even read Dragon Ball. Everyone was eagerly waiting your work. I wish the wishes of Dragon Ball existed. Maybe it's selfish, but I'm so sad. Thank you, Toriyama, for your work for over 45 years. Thank you for your efforts and hard work. The remaining members of your family are deeply wounded. Please take care of yourself and rest in peace."
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to hear the great mangakas of our time even, you know, referring to him in this way, and just to think about the kind of legacy that he had and the impact that he had on these creators too. It's very evident. There's just a huge outpour of support. And
yeah, I mean, there are statements made by the creators of Slam Dunk, the creator of Bleach, the creator of Spy Family made a statement as well. Like I've been looking at just, and there's just so many, and they all have a lot of very like similar sentiments of like, you know, I can't believe this. This is heartbreaking. Like you are like the groundwork of this industry, you know? So it is tough to read about this and not be affected. And really also, I mean, for someone like me, I can only speak from my experience. Like I'm someone, and I mentioned this in the beginning, who kind of wrote off Dragon Ball, even though I watched it as a child. But mm-hmm. some of the fans have made me personally feel like some type of way. But you know, it's one of those things where you don't know what you have till it's gone. And like with his passing, it's been a big realization for me of his impact and the impact of this show and the impact of these characters that has really put a different worldly perspective, I think, on the franchise as a whole for someone like me. And I could only hope for a lot of other people like me that, like, maybe this isn't their favorite thing, or, you know, that they could just have a deeper appreciation for this creator and what this show has done for this industry as a whole.
Agreed. Agreed. And with that, I think that will be our episode for today. It's really hard to put to words everything, but hopefully you've learned a little bit more about Akira Toriyama and his life and kind of his trajectory and how Dragon Ball came to be, and a little bit about its success. Hopefully you learned something. Just really grateful. Without him, it's no exaggeration to say, like, without Akira Toriyama, Shonen wouldn't be what it is today. The world of anime as we know it wouldn't be what it is today. Quite frankly, I don't even know if I would have been able to watch it, because even Toonami's success was built on the back of Dragon Ball success. So
yeah,
anime as a medium in North America, period, just wouldn't be what it is today. So yeah, I've been a binge monster.
And I've been a green queen. Thanks for listening.